Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Endgame. Joining me, as always, to bring the game is Bill Fleckenstein. Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm fine, mate. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. You're back in the People's Republic of Seattle, I see.
I am back in the People's Republic of Seattle, home of Woke Central.
Home of Woke Central.
So this will be a three-peat for Mike. He's right up there with the Lord of the Dark Matter.
What can we say? Only the very best make it to the top of that Mount Rushmore, and he belongs up there alongside James for sure. I mean, there's so much to talk about, and Mike is always such a thought-provoking guest. It seems like the perfect time to bring him back with so much going on in the world. Bill, what do you say?
Let's do it.
Mr. Green, welcome back to The Endgame, my friend. It's a pleasure to almost see you again after, geez, you were one of our, I think you were guest number four, weren't you?
Yeah, something like that. It was a lot of fun to one of the early guests, and it's amazing to watch how the podcast has developed. So we're still on at an end game, though. That's the point.
Well, isn't it? And that's the beauty of the thing. You were the guy who said, the very first words you said on that podcast were, well, of course, there is no end game. And of course, that's exactly right. And so what Bill and I have been trying to flesh out is the kind of move from here to there. We all kind of know where here is. None of us know where there is and what it looks like. And so that's been the kind of job of this conversation, to chronicle that as we go along. So big part of that has obviously been the passive stuff, and you've become increasingly vocal and your profile has soared accordingly, which is great. And so a lot more people are getting to hear you thinking about this stuff out loud. So let me give you a really, really broad question to kick this thing off. As you said, we're not at the end game. How have things changed, do you think, in the time since our first conversation to now? Big picture stuff that you focus on.
Well, I mean, I think that's actually a great question, because among other things, you start by saying we all know where we are here. I actually think that's one of the most fascinating things, is that right now, I don't think anyone agrees where we are here, right? Are we in recession?
Yes. And that's the problem. We all know, but no one agrees, right?
Right. I know you've used the line several times, but it's a little bit like the, well, how would you get to Dublin? Well, you don't want to start from here, right?
Exactly.
So, if I think about how things have changed, I'd say that there's two or three things that I would really emphasize. So one, unfortunately, a lot of the theoretical framework that I began to lay out in the immediate aftermath of the pandemic, the impact of passive investing, the dominance of option strategies, and the mechanical aspects of many of these things, I think have become much more mainstream in terms of awareness, as you pointed out. And in many ways, it's been one of the more fun things is actually watching the academic literature that has flourished since that discussion. In particular, people are sick of hearing me cite the academics, but, look at the work of Gabay and Koijin, look at the extension of their work by Bouchaud, or Valentin Haddad at UCLA, his work on how competitive are stock markets, et cetera. And they're all coming through and saying the exact same thing. And you see it in something like NVIDIA, right, which has jumped over $200 billion in market cap overnight. And, miraculously, like this is the thing I guess I would just, highlight for people, is everyone says it's short covering.
No.
But NVIDIA only had 1% of its shares short.
Definitely not short covering.
Right. So, and you sit there and you look at the behavior, and in all honesty, look at the intraday behavior in NVIDIA, right? It goes up 90 points overnight and then basically says, yeah, that's the right price. It's a really extraordinary phenomenon when you think about it, right? It's like there's very little continuation intraday. There will be some short covering associated with it. I agree, Fleck. I don't think there's any chance that the amount of shorts that were outstanding on something like this can cause this type of behavior. But what can cause it are all the dynamics that I've talked about, right? Mm-hmm. So passive markets making markets increasingly inelastic, because coming in this morning, Vanguard had to buy NVIDIA alongside the shorts, alongside the dealers who are hedging the short call positions that they had entered into. Those who had decided to overwrite, for example, right, had are now suddenly scrambling to reestablish their position. So all of these things are happening in an environment of extreme inelasticity for individual stocks. And again, I would point people to, you know, the headlines from Valentin Haddad's 2020 paper on how competitive the stock market is, especially February 2021, you know, where he highlights that individual stocks have become increasingly inelastic, which is the economic term saying how much does price move for a change in supply and demand. On very small changes in supply and demand, we're seeing unconscionable shifts in pricing. So, you know, I think, unfortunately, like, all that stuff is bearing out. On the flip side of it, the economic developments, I think, couldn't have been, in my view at least, couldn't have been handled worse.
Worse, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You know, I think the initial stimulus from the Trump administration in terms of allowing people to stay at home once they made the fateful and, as I've always argued, very wrong decision to begin shutting down the country and really the globe, you know, I think that was a terrible decision. And I spoke very clearly about that at the time. You know, we'll never really understand why we behaved the way that we did, but there was some form of collective psychosis clearly emerged where we had all the plans in place for how do you handle a novel respiratory virus and pandemic. And we just threw them out the window and decided to behave in a really weird way, right? And that happens in history, right? We have, you know, crazy religious movements where suddenly everybody decides to behave in really weird fashion. So we flooded the system with stimulus, basically allowing people to stay at home. We forced people to evacuate cities, as we've seen in almost every pandemic in history. This drove an incredible demand for single-family housing away from other people. It caused a demand increase for people who wanted to live by themselves as compared to with their roommates, et cetera. And, you know, we've seen all these shifts in behavioral patterns that emerged from it. And a large part, a lot of that was accommodated in 2020 and early 2021. And then it just kind of turned into a free-for-all of, well, let's just give people money, right? And that extended to business owners, that extended to individuals with disabilities that didn't want to work or couldn't work. It extended to people that were impacted by, you know, floods in California. The list goes on. And all of that is still trickling through the system. It's some of the stuff that the Republicans are reasonably pointing to in the debt ceiling negotiations and saying, you know, like, it's kind of silly, guys, that we still have money that is unspent from COVID stimulus. We've declared the pandemic is over. We should at minimum be clawing that back. And at the same time, you know, nobody likes to be held hostage to this. So I'm sympathetic to some of the points of view on the Democratic side as well. We had that craziness on the fiscal side. Now, of course, we've had multiple levels of craziness on the interest rate and monetary policy side. And it was fairly clear as early as May of 2020 that we were going to see inflationary impacts from all of the dynamics associated with the COVID shutdowns, right? You know, May 2020, I was highlighting how inflationary it was going to be on a forward-looking basis that oil had actually gone negative, right? It shuts in production. It ends up, of course, showing up in the headline CPI indices. And we also knew that the construction of many of the metrics that are supposed to tell us of inflationary conditions, things like owner's equivalent rent, were horribly lagging in their construction and largely built to reflect what was perceived as a general level of stability, you know, the great moderation over the period beforehand. That led the Fed to be far too aggressive for too long. And the thing that I have the problem with right now that worries me the most is, of course, we've now flipped in the opposite direction. We've instituted the most radical monetary policy, most radical tightening of interest rates, shrinking of balance sheets, et cetera, that we've really ever seen in history, with the very predictable effect that it's destroying the regional banking system, right? It's pulling deposits out of the system at an astonishing rate that is, you know, really unparalleled in a lot of ways. Very few examples of it, not totally unparalleled. And that was actually, you know, Ragnarotham Rajan, the famous RBI Bank of India central banker, presented a paper in the summer at Jackson Hole saying, you got to be really careful when you're hiking interest rates in this manner because you're going to destroy elements of the financial system. And it was ignored. And here we are. We've had the three largest bank failures in U.S. history. We've got a number of banks that are barely holding on. You know, people are sending me flyers from banks ranging from U.S. Bank Corp to J.P. Morgan, where to open a new business account and agree to keep funds in there, you're looking at, you know, annualized rates of return north of 50%. as banks are desperate to show some stabilization of deposits. And all of this is happening before we actually start to recognize the credit cycle that is underway, that's leading to incredibly poor recoveries in levered loans and, you know, rising default rates, rising delinquency rates in everything ranging from auto repossessions to credit card debt to, we're actually starting to see some of the uptick begin in places like mortgages. This could get really ugly. People are very comforted by the low levels of unemployment. And every recession starts from low unemployment, right? It's a tautology. So, you know, when people start losing their jobs, things get bad. But, you know, that's part of the point is that there is a very strong debate. Are we in recession? Are we ever going to have a recession? Which, of course, are the words you hear and you start to shake in your boots if you've been doing this long enough. I would argue that's kind of where we are. We've squandered an opportunity that could have been unifying, right? That could have been something that said, hey, let's all pull together and let's respect each other's best efforts to isolate those around us and protect those around us. This could be a unifying dynamic. And instead, it's turned into one of those fractious events in certainly American history and possibly in geopolitical history, because you are beginning to see all the anti-immigrant movements. You are beginning to see, you know, the behaviors that are suggesting that basically people are increasingly angry with each other, including a land war in Europe.
On that happy note, Mike, this is going to be a hard question for you to answer, I think, but I have to ask it. One of the things when I first met you, I guess it was 3 years ago now, I kept thinking to myself, the markets had stopped discounting the way I had grown up seeing them do that. Mm-hmm. And then when you explained the passive bid and the option impact, things started to make sense. And so from everything I've seen you say or heard you say, you've been very measured in trying to describe what the impact of passive is and how it impacts things. From a qualitative standpoint, based on what you know, which is probably more about passive than anyone, how much has that impacted the market in that? I mean, we know that it's plus or minus 50% of the daily activity. I think that's the most recent number I saw. But from a qualitative standpoint, given the negative litany of things that you just mentioned and valuations and all of that, one would have thought that were it not for the passive bid, the market would already be lower and that might be reinforcing itself in weaker economic activity. Could you take any kind of a stab at talking about this from a somewhat qualitative standpoint so people can kind of have a better understanding of how warped things are?
Yeah, it's a great question, though. And so one of the things I would highlight for people is that I don't have the statistics as of today, right? But I'm guessing that the rally has not changed anything meaningfully just looking at the headline behavior. The Russell 2000, for example, is actually down today, right? Or the Russell 2000 value, more precisely.
Yeah, and so is the Russell.
And so is the Russell. Okay, so I'm not in front of my screens right now. So if you look at what happened in 2022, there's a really interesting feature of passive that I'd highlighted in advance that I think played out almost perfectly. This is tied to the work of Jonathan Parker or to Hannah Lustig's work at Stanford. And it's looking at the dynamic of what happens when you have large systematic rebalancers between bonds and equities, people who run portfolios that they need to rebalance on a continuous basis. What I think happened in 2022 is if you just mechanically imagine that you're running a portfolio that's 50-50 bonds and equities, and then you have this deus ex machina animal that we call the Federal Reserve that comes in and hikes interest rates, causing your bond portfolio to fall because of its duration exposure, not because of its credit exposure, but because of its duration exposure. The bond portion of your portfolio has now fallen. What do you have to do with equities? You have to sell equities and buy bonds to rebalance the portfolio. That behavior is almost exactly what we saw throughout 2022, right? We saw the Vanguard Total Market Index and the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index trade almost like a double helix in DNA, right? Just balancing off of each other throughout the course of the year. There were some components of credit earlier in the year. There was an incredible impact on the consumer in the first half of the year that I largely credit for the declines that we saw that led many, myself included, by the way, to think that we were earlier into a recession than we actually were. that was tied to the incredible increase in oil prices, the pressure that put on household balance sheets. You saw some widening of credit spreads associated with some of those dynamics as well. And then as oil prices fell in the back half of the year, consumers reclaimed a huge portion of their balance sheets. Things got a little bit better, but you still saw this underlying pattern of going back and forth, right? Mm-hmm. If I think about what's happened on a year-to-date basis, everything I'm seeing suggests that the markets are actually down to sideways in terms of the overall behavior. But one of the things about going into passive is remember that you're buying into strategies that are purchasing stocks on a market cap, more accurately, a float-weighted basis, right? The problem is, and this is the work of Bouchaud in 2020, 2021, extending the work of Gabay and Khoijan, the inelastic market hypothesis, liquidity in the market doesn't scale with market cap. Liquidity in the market scales with market-making activities. The profitability of market-making activities is determined by the volume and the volatility of the stock. So as a market maker, you'll put more capital up and you'll facilitate more liquidity for a stock that has a ton of volume, a ton of interest, a ton of trading transaction dynamics to it. And that's not going to necessarily scale with market capitalization, right? And so just a really simple example, the largest stock by market cap we all know is Apple, although in another 2 days, it might be NVIDIA at this pace. So when you look at Apple's market cap, somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.5 trillion, its market capitalization is roughly 100 times larger than the smallest stock in the S&P 500, but its liquidity is only about 5 times more. Right. So just like we talked about with the dynamics around the dot-com cycle, where you had this weird component of market cap weighted indices and stocks like Microsoft had far fewer shares available. Now that's being replaced by the dynamics of every time Vanguard or BlackRock or any passive entity shows up to buy the index on behalf of their investors, that purchase in turn is distorting the market by putting far more demand into Apple or Microsoft relative to the liquidity versus, say, a Delta Airlines, for example. And so when you have a situation emerge like you have right now, where I would argue that actually people are incredibly low conviction, right? Most institutional investors will acknowledge that the underlying economy actually looks pretty weak on a marginal basis, right? It's certainly decelerated dramatically. Valuations are very rich. And candidly, there's a super compelling alternative called short-term bonds right now that offer yields that we haven't seen in a very long time. So the institutional investors are largely standing by the sidelines, but they're protecting their downside, or they're missing out to the top side, more accurately, by buying call options on the S&P 500, right? That causes pressure upwards on the S&P 500 in that passive framework and pushes up the largest stocks. That's then augmented further by the giant buyback programs of Microsoft, Apple, et cetera, Google. They all have giant buyback programs that any frictional market analysis has to be driving the shares higher. And so we're seeing this incredible divergence. And it's a bizarre divergence that I see in patterns across the market, whether it's comparing the S&P to the Russell, whether it's comparing economic indices that would historically have tracked extraordinarily well with the behavior of things like high yield credit spreads to the actual credit spreads themselves, right? We're seeing incredible tightness in credit spreads relative to what you would expect. The whole thing feels very, you know, those alligator jaws are growing when we talk about these divergences. And the question is, which way do they snapshot? Do they snapshot with us all suddenly say, oh, that was a bad dream, and the economy reaccelerates? Or do they snapshot with what I would certainly view as some form of a reversal to at least the hard data that we're receiving? But we haven't seen that yet. And so, you know, guys like myself or other people who have played tail dynamics before, I was speaking with Bose Weinstein the other day, we're all seeing the same thing and saying, holy cow, this looks crazy. And we think there's an incredible opportunity to basically be bearish in some areas of the market right now. But it's really hard to argue that, you know, you can hold that forever, right? This is a very strange place.
Mike, you offered up a clue just there when you talked about last year, maybe the bonds going down was causing the rebalance. When I discussed this with you in the past, I thought they only rebalanced every group of years. So have you learned more about that as to when they rebalance and how long it takes before bond weakness triggers them to have to do that? I think that's an important clue to how they behave, they being passive.
Yeah, so there's two separate rebalances that we're talking about there. So the target date funds themselves used to rebalance every 5 years, right? So if you bought the 2035 Vanguard Retirement Fund, every 5 years, it would change its allocation within the glide path. It would cut its equity exposure. It would raise its bond exposure. So that's the five-year component that you're talking about. Now, they changed that in 2018, I think it was, where they moved to smooth glide paths where they change on a somewhat continuous basis now. Part of the reason why I think they did that is in prior rebalance, what appear to be prior rebalancing periods in 2010 and 2015, those rebalancing impacts appeared to have caused phenomena that we refer to as flash crashes.
Okay.
So again, this has been an action by these market participants that acknowledges their market influence and market power and has effectively bought them increased capacity, right? So they're smoothing that rebalance. It's important and good that they're doing this, right? The rebalancing that I'm referring to, though, is actually rebalancing that happens on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis within these target date funds. And so if, and we see this very mechanically across a variety of different strategies, if you're managing a target date fund and you're receiving inflows every single day, if bonds are outperforming equities without having to sell your bond portfolio, you can direct your marginal inflows into equities, for example, right? To try to match this as we go forward.
Okay.
But you're not the only player in the market. You're not in control of all the information. You certainly can't control prices per se. You're just influencing them as you participate. And so then the second thing that happens is again, this has been from discussions with some target date providers. Others may have slightly different strategies. My understanding of the way most of them are managed is somewhere around 5 trading days from the end of the month when they want to be able to send out their monthly reporting saying we're in our allocations, they will actually begin to actively deploy. And if there are events like a Federal Reserve interest rate hike that causes a substantive repricing, again, you're going to see this behavior of, you know, the bonds get pushed down and then they have to start buying more and more bonds, which starts to raise the bond price, lower the yields, right? And you go through that process on a continuous basis, just rebalancing and smoothing out that relationship. But a great chart for people to pull up is to pull up the ratio of VTI, which is the Vanguard Total Market Index ETF, to BND, which is their same for the bond market ETF. And if you look at what happened in 2022, it literally just went sideways, right? Totally unlike any bear market in history, but very similar, by the way, to what we've seen in the past several Fed hiking cycles. So, periods of pause like 2015, 2016, or 2014 to 2015, where the Fed began to normalize for the first time, or what I would argue is a broad pause from 2018 until 2020, where the markets largely went sideways and then broke out post-pandemic, right? But, very different behavior than we've seen previously. And again, I think it's this portfolio rebalancing channel. I'd love for somebody to tell me otherwise.
Well, listen, if there's someone out there with that opinion, they will chime in. I promise you that much. That's the beauty of being visible on Twitter. The kind of perpetual motion machine that you've described there, when you talk about the fact that no one can agree on where we are, I think that's very true. And that's a big part of it. Because I think we all kind of know where we think we are and we're all very dogmatic about it. But when you look across that landscape that you just laid out so beautifully and you talk about there are plenty of places where you and other guys looking at the same stuff feel like you can get bearish. What does it take? What are you looking for? What glitch in this kind of matrix are you looking for as a sign that everything you've just talked about and the way it works in unison and in harmony to drive prices higher, what does it take and what are you looking for to when it starts to go the other way and self-reinforces on the downside?
Yeah. So first of all, it's a hypothesis that that's going to occur, although I feel increasingly confident in that hypothesis. The second is what you're effectively saying, what's the catalyst, right? And
in all honesty, I would never throw the catalyst thing at you because I think that's a very unfair question, but there must be places where you see more stress in that.
Absolutely. And so that actually is a totally fair question, by the way. And I'm always seeking out dynamics like that, right? Now, you want to position yourself favorably for that. So, you know, I've highlighted this for people repeatedly. The XIV blowup, the Balmageddon event, for example, that was a matter of identifying that under these conditions, which were highly probable over a defined period of time, you would see the catalyst emerge in some way, shape, or form that would take that product down. Mechanically, it was running a 22 beta to the S&P 500. That meant that if the S&P 500 fell 4%, it would cross its 85% force majeure clause on drawdowns and cause Credit Suisse to liquidate the fund, right? That was a very straightforward and simple analysis. And it just became a matter of saying, okay, what's the probability effectively of a 4% drawdown over the course of, you know, any given period? Equities themselves don't really have an embedded catalyst. There's nothing that keeps markets from getting more irrational versus while you try to remain solvent in that process. And this is one of the reasons why, like, I've cautiously said, you know, something along the lines of Chuck Prince, when the music's playing, you've still got to dance. For the very simple reason that this is a cumulative process. And the further it goes, the crazier things can actually get, as we're seeing with companies like NVIDIA today. Where I would argue you can see catalysts emerge, and this is why credit tends to do a better job of forecasting than equity markets do, where you see catalysts emerge are where companies actually have cash events. So bonds have maturities. Bonds have coupon payments. If they fail to make those, then a catalyst is basically endogenous to the actual bond process itself. And I would argue that we're actually seeing those catalysts begin to emerge in terms of commercial credit, commercial real estate defaults, the rising delinquencies, et cetera. And we're also seeing a really interesting dynamic that I would argue is playing out in the corporate sector, where as people become more comfortable with the idea that we're close to the end of the rate hiking cycle, right? We may get another hike, we may get two more hikes, but we're not going to get 500 basis points more hikes, or at least, God, I hope we're not. And as a result, you're starting to see people rotate out of floating rate debt into fixed rate debt for a variety of reasons. So I actually think that you're seeing areas of the market that have better catalysts than the equity markets. In particular, I think credit is super interesting. And the nice part about that, though, is once a credit cycle starts, then the factors that I think will actually impact the flows into equities begin to hit. And those are things like rising unemployment, et cetera. We've been really protected from the employment cycle because there's been such an extended construction cycle, largely in the multifamily space, right? So Warren Pease has done work on this. I've highlighted some of my differences with his analysis, but would emphasize that those dynamics are coming to an end, right? We are seeing permits fall. We are seeing permits in multifamily fall. We are seeing areas move that would suggest that the employment cycle is starting to turn, right? We're now consistently printing over 200,000 in jobless claims and 1.9 in continuing claims. And when all of those accumulate, it ultimately means that you're going to see far less contributions into 401ks, the passive funds, et cetera. And that's what I'm really looking for, right? And we are seeing some evidence of it. We are seeing slowing flows. They're not negative yet, though. You know, that's going to be the interesting component is if they do go negative, the bid that is required to sustain liquidity in the face of that is not something you encounter very often.
Can you say that again, please, Mike?
Sure. So the example that I use for people all the time is again, the Vanguard Total Market Index, right? So remember that this is over a $1 trillion fund that has, as of my last check on it, you know, $83 million worth of liquidity to meet redemptions, right? Now, they actually aren't going to meet it out of that, and they do have small lines of credit that they can use to facilitate daily liquidity. But when we start talking about, you know, a $1 trillion fund that has to sell into the market in reduced liquidity conditions, like we've all lived through $1 billion fund blowups that we saw substantively affect the S&P 500, right? Imagine a 1 or a 5% redemption coming out of a Vanguard type product. We just can't handle it. There's no ability to manage against that liquidity.
Mike, let me ask you, there's one story that was bubbling up during the Silicon Valley Bank situation that I saw intermittently get a fair bit of coverage from people on FinTwit and places like that, but not really much elsewhere. And that's Charles Schwab. Because what you just said, you know, all of this kind of feeds into the problems that could occur at Chuck Schwab. So what's your take on that? Is it caught up in this Silicon Valley thing? Is it a problem? And if that becomes a problem, as certainly the CDS activity on the stock would suggest some people think it may be, what does that do and how does that upset the entire dynamic that you've laid out?
Well, so, you know, this is going to sound like Ben Bernanke in terms of subprime is contained, right? and it's naivete. The only way anything ever affects something is if it changes the liquidity characteristics. So if people who are investors in Charles Schwab suddenly become fearful of their investments in Charles Schwab, as they did of their deposits at First Republic, or even if they get to a point where they recognize that not only are their deposits potentially at risk or their assets potentially at risk, but much more importantly, they can earn more money doing something else, like lending to the US government as compared to lending to small business, right? Then you'll see these rotational dynamics. And I think that's what's so fascinating about what's going on in the banking system right now is that people are arguing that the banking system problems are contained. While I'm getting notes saying that banks are trying to source funds at 50 to 60% cost of capital. Like, that's crazy, guys. I know that's not actually what it is because they're effectively making a bid for a deposit franchise. But come on. Like, if banks are paying me $500 to borrow $5,000 for 2 months, they are not turning around and lending to the local pizza shop and saying, yeah, no, sure, here, we'll finance your expansion. That's just not going to happen. And they certainly aren't going to be lending money to build the next skyscraper in their local town. And this is something we're seeing play out all over the place. The problem is, of course, that these things, they have multiple impacts. But the two things that I would just emphasize for people is when you hike interest rates as fast as we have, and I actually had an exchange with somebody on Twitter, and I hadn't actually thought of framing it this way until I saw their question. That's one of the reasons I love being on things like Twitter is because people will ask questions that you're like, well, wait, that's absolutely the wrong way to frame the question. And the conclusion is the total opposite, but it stimulated thought nonetheless, right? And so the point was raised, like, why hasn't the US economy been more sensitive to the change in interest rates? And my reaction to that actually is like, oh my God, this has been the most sensitive I've ever seen it. Because what we've actually seen is even before the Fed began to hike, housing starts and permits began to fall. The minute the forwards began to incorporate pricing of higher interest rates, which we saw in early 2021, the market turned, the meme stock craze began to break. All the super speculative stuff began to fall apart pretty early on. That it hasn't manifested itself yet in unemployment is really what everybody is saying. But all the other indicators are already in the toilet. I mean, for God's sakes, guys, look at the ISM manufacturing indices. Look at the deceleration that we've seen in the services industries. This is not telling you that the economy is super robust. So that's one component of it. The second is just the mechanical aspect of it. So, you know, let's think about something like new cars. And you're beginning to see the impact of this, I would argue, in the forward-looking inflation expectations numbers. You know, I bought a car in 2019, fortunately, right? And so I've had no reason to replace that car through this cycle. I will eventually have to replace that car. Fortunately, I'm not financing it, but, you know, my car, if I were to go out and buy it today, if I had financed it in 2019 versus going out to finance it today, my payment would be up probably 90%. Right. And somebody going to replace that car today, that's when they're going to get hit with this. That's when they're going to experience the reality of higher auto prices. With your average new car being held by somebody for, I believe it's about 48 months now, that's a pretty typical experience. Most people have not actually experienced the dynamic of higher car prices. They certainly haven't experienced the dynamic of higher car payments. And yet that's slowly accumulating through the economy as both the higher prices and the higher interest rates remain in place. I think that's important. I think it's really important to understand that cumulative impact and, you know, just to put an absolute number on it. On my calculations right now, the median American household's budget, right? And I emphasize median because when you use things like average or you aggregate all of the cost of auto across the entire economy, right? You're blending together Bill Gates and me, and Bill Gates will candidly never care about the cost of a new car. So when you look at that median American household, purchasing a new car is impairing their household budget by about 6% a year for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years. Right. That's a, I mean, that's more than the savings rate, right? So it's a huge impact that we're seeing as individual households subsequently have to make these purchases. And I think that's a big chunk of what we're actually starting to see is the reality of those are actually hitting people, right? We all know that car prices went up, but very few people actually bought cars, right? I mean, there's 125 million American households. We sell 15 million cars a year. So in any given year, you know, maybe 10% of Americans actually experience that dynamic.
Let me bring this around away from the market, because as you said there, when you talked about this being a really sensitive cycle to interest rates, it's impossible not to be when they get jacked up so far, so fast. And I think the big disconnect and the reason so many people are confused about where we are and where we're going is exactly that. It's that, like, the delay in, or the time lag between these rises and something that they can recognize as a problem, i.e. the market falling. So we're still in this place where everyone is convinced the pivot is coming. Everyone is convinced that it's going to happen soon. Everyone's convinced that rates are headed back to zero. So let's talk about our friends at the Federal Reserve.
So if you think about the equation that I just ran through, right? There's a mechanism by which I can influence the behavior of equities through raising interest rates and causing bond prices to fall. But once I get to the point that my interest rate increases are no longer meaningfully impacting the bond market, and this just happens from duration sensitivity, right? So if I go from 0% rates to 1%, that has a big impact on the market. 1% to 2% has a smaller, right? 2 to 3, smaller still, 3 to 4, 4 to 5, et cetera. And so the initial impact on asset prices can occur through that rebalancing channel, but nowhere in any of the calculations that I just referred to did I do a discounted cash flow analysis in which I projected out forward cash flows and I worked it back to a valuation, right? So what everybody is looking for is you know, some variant of the language that we've all conveniently forgotten. Oh, the reason equity prices were so high is because interest rates were so low. You'd point people to Europe where that was, you know, theoretically even more the case, or Japan where it was theoretically even more the case. And they're like, yeah, well, you know, America has all the best companies. Right now, again, that may be true, tends not to be, at least in history. And yet here we are, now interest rates are dramatically higher and valuations haven't meaningfully retreated in any reasonable way. They certainly haven't retreated to where they were the last time we were at these levels of interest rates. You know, I hate to say it this way, but like I told you so. Interest rates don't actually play the same role in valuation that they do in very simplistic discounted cash flow models. Because nobody that's actually gaining any assets in terms of equity allocations uses discounted models anymore. All the money is going into factor funds. All of the money is going into passive indices. And I'm not aware of any passive index that says, you know, okay, well, given the level of interest rates and the forecasted, you know, estimates for the S&P 500, here's our allocation to equities. It just doesn't do it. That's not the way it works anymore. It really is just a function of the flows. And the flows largely are generated by employment, and employment has not yet retreated. And so we've taken a model of the market that historically was meant to provide a discounting mechanism that reflected the judgment of individual players, which would allow the incorporation of things like, well, do we think there's going to be a recession? Do we think that the Fed's interest rate hikes are going to cause a huge impact? And we don't have it anymore. And yet, ironically, our policymakers refer to that and look at it and say, you know, well, what is the market pricing in? What does the market seem to expect? I'm actually sitting down with Chem Carson today here at the Equity Derivatives Conference. This, by the way, is the conference where I predicted the collapse of the XIV, to talk precisely about this issue. You know, the title of our segment is called, you know, Can the Market See the Brick Wall Ahead? The conclusion is no, because so many of these mechanical factors drive the behaviors that we see.
So, Mike, it's obvious that you're bearish on the economy and bearish on the market. As someone who's been a practitioner of trying to be short, I know how difficult it is, but it was difficult before we had to deal with this new structure. If you're going to run something with a bearish tilt, let's say, especially as it pertains to equities. You have to take into consideration the game that you're actually playing, which has this 800-pound gorilla that's running the show. So I'm assuming that as you try to express your bearishness or to capitalize on the downside where you can do that, we obviously have that front and center in your mind. So I would assume, though, that you're also looking for the moment when the 800-pound gorilla might actually turn to a seller, and that'll allow you to beef up your positions. I'm assuming that's part of a tactic you have in those sorts of strategies. Am I correct in assuming that?
So in our hedged credit product, for example, which, fingers crossed, is going to actually be the first 40 Act fund that has the capability of including credit CDS in it. I'm actually very excited about that opportunity. We currently hedge by using an equity long short overlay that's worked fantastically well, that actually perversely is long many of the large cap high quality names that benefit from indexing, and short a lot of stuff that is economically cyclical and has the embedded credit catalyst, right? And so that's done extraordinarily well on a year-to-date basis in terms of protecting that credit portfolio. In the macro portfolio, to be very straightforward, in that macro portfolio, I have taken losses in shorting individual securities. Fortunately, that's been more than offset by gains elsewhere. And so, unlike many in the space, I'm actually up, which is encouraging and gives me some staying power. But most of my risk-off expressions at this point are actually increasingly tail-based hedges that are saying, I think that there's a fairly significant break that is likely to emerge because we've engaged in so much vol compression. And like we saw in 2018, there are some catalysts in place that I think have the potential to meaningfully change that dynamic. We've gone to the point where we have experienced basically the lowest sensitivity of equity volatility to realized price changes in the S&P. We've moved, because of the zero day to expiry option dynamic, we've moved away from referencing hedges at the relatively expensive 30-day horizon or longer term horizon. And increasingly, we're focusing all of our expression of protection at the very front of the equity curve, literally in days, right? And we can see this. So like when, you know, Chairman Powell is going to speak, for example, there'll be an uptick in volatility associated with that day. Now, the thing that's so fascinating about what's transpired is in the space of 6 months, we've gone from days where Powell speaks or where CPI releases occur that would have in November, for example, in November of last year, or even in February of this year, there were very regularly individual days in which the VIX equivalent, right, the implied volatility for that day was printing in the 50s or 60s. Right. So that became obviously a day that the market was placing a lot of emphasis on. There's a lot of fear around it. The past couple of Fed meetings, the market has basically priced no response. And by and large, has actually been right. Right. It's been very contained. And so there is just no interest in expressing fear. And the reason why, of course, is because just like 2017 into 2018, everyone has flipped to being short vol. It's just been such a fantastic trade. And in particular, I would argue they're increasingly short gamma, where they're selling those zero day to expiry options. And that's a very logical trade, right? Because if we just stick with the old adage that 85% of options expire worthless, well, if I'm engaged in a very high probability trade, what's the single best way to increase my Sharpe ratio? I do it as frequently as I possibly can.
Let me interrupt one sec, Mike. When you say the euphemistic everyone, are you talking about retail or just fast money hedge fund types?
Largely on the institutional side. So the zero day to expiry phenomenon has moved from one that was kind of retail punting on the long side. Mm-hmm. And institutions using it to hedge individual events, as I was describing, because even if I'm paying, you know, 50 vol for one day, for example.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It's one day, right? I mean, there's just not that much vol there. And I mean, there were situations where I would scalp that within funds that I'd manage, but just to, you know, give at a reasonable size to that sort of trade, you're talking about you can add 1 to 2 basis points a day from that sort of scalping. You're not adding 1% or 2% unless you're going absolutely bananas in terms of the notional, which would be a bad choice. So everything we're seeing suggests that the vast majority of zero-day to expiry options are now being net sold. And that is creating conditions where, you know, you've heard me talk about these dynamics. Certainly, if you read the tier one stuff we put out, we talk about this an awful lot. But when I sell options to a dealer, I'm providing that dealer, I'm giving them a long volatility exposure. They can then be used to manage their overall position in markets. And they want to hedge that, right? They want to harvest that volatility position as profitably as they can. And they're really good at it. That ends up being a very volatility suppressing dynamic, which is what we're seeing in the markets. It feels like it should be crazy, right? Like, it feels like we should be going bananas, but right. That's not what's happening.
But let me take you back to what you said, and I'm still mulling this over, which is why I've kept my mouth shut for the last 5 minutes, because I'm still rattling around my head. When you talked about the fact that these rising rates don't necessarily matter to equities anymore because no one's using that forward cash flow model, which is ringing so many bells in my head. What does that mean, and what are the implications for when rates start to fall? Because presumably, rates start to fall, everyone's going to buy the index again, and it feels like we've reached this perfect nirvana where rising rates don't matter to equities. There's a bit of trouble, they start cutting rates, and equities are off to the races.
So yeah, the mechanism I would use is slightly different, right? Which is when the Fed starts cutting rates, bond prices go up, all else being equal. Bond prices going up in that rebalancing framework means I need to sell bonds, buy equities. So I don't think it's the discounted cash flow dynamic. I do think that there is a psychological element that many in the markets are waiting for the Fed to be done.
Yeah, I wasn't clear. I didn't mean that there was a discounted cash flow on the other side. I just meant that when the cutting of rates is a signal to just buy equities.
Right. And so that's where the question becomes really interesting, right? And where it becomes so fascinating that the Fed has locked in so hard. Because if they were to decide, you know, let's say they took my advice and they were to decide to start cutting rates today in recognition that they've created stresses in the economy that are going to take, you know, 3, 6, 9 months to percolate through and things like commercial real estate, job loss, et cetera. Again, because these things take time, right? You know, if they were to start cutting it today, I agree with you. That almost everybody's reaction to that would be, okay, this is good. But if they're cutting rates because it's, you know, the Powell flip-flop in the fourth quarter of 2018 and equity markets are down 20% already, I'm not sure that it has ultimately the same impact. Part of the reason for that is when you have super low volatility in assets, as we have been realizing, that in turn creates conditions under which I don't have to post much margin against them, certainly not internally in things like VAR models, et cetera. As that volatility rises, I now need more collateral. So perversely, you end up with more demand for risk-free assets as volatility ends up increasing, or the flip side of that is less demand for risky assets. And so it really does become a question of how quickly does the Fed respond? Does the Fed respond to a violent economic signal, or is the Fed responding to a forward-looking signal? And again, this is part of the reason why I'm screaming at the top of my lungs that we're so far behind on the cutting side versus the hiking side, which everybody seems to think. Because ultimately, I think that we're unfortunately creating conditions that are going to lead to sudden stops. And those sudden stops typically emerge in credit markets where suddenly a borrower can't refinance. Credit problems occur for two reasons. One is operating deterioration. The second is because you actually end up having a sudden stop in your ability to refinance stuff, right? So in both situations, when I have a bond maturing, I'm unable to roll that principal over. Suddenly cash becomes due that I don't have on hand. That's what levered companies encounter all the time during credit cycles. And that's the point that I would suggest is beginning to approach. Too many of these companies can't refinance. They cannot take these rates.
I was thinking of your friend Mike Taylor's wonderful description of that as a date with Dr. Zero.
Yeah.
For all the years I ran money on the short side, I'd never heard that expression. My favorite one up to that point was, I'm so bearish, I'm a seller at zero. But
Yeah. Well, those are all it wouldn't be a Mike Green discussion without a history book tour. But, you know, we take for granted that idea that zero is a floor. Right. And we forget that was a 19th century innovation, right? That was, you know, the limited liability corporation that protects an equity holder against claims over and above their investment. you know, didn't occur until the late 19th century. And so, the world that we inhabit is a rules-based world that has not been around nearly as long as we think it has.
Look, but if there's one thing that we've seen challenged in the last few years, Mike, it's this idea of zero, right? We saw it with rates. We saw it with bond yields. We've seen it with oil prices. Zero is not the floor it used to be anymore.
I'm hopeful that that's the case in equities, but yes, I agree with you. I mean, we saw it with oil. Oil is a perfect example. And you know, I made this point very clear to people in April, May of 2020, right? Remember that oil is like, it's a toxic substance. So if you don't have certified facilities to put it in, you can't just like store it in your bathtub. It just doesn't work that way. Copper is totally different. If copper prices went negative, people would go start sticking copper in their garage, right? To speculate, because it wouldn't leach through the floor and everything else. But like, you know, a toxic substance like oil, you can't do anything with it. So it can't actually easily go negative, which, you know, shocked the hell out of everybody. I don't think anything like that's going to happen anytime soon. But one of the points that I raised, you know, in my Substack at the very beginning of the year, when everyone was super bullish, the China reopening and that narrative, is that, you know, the underlying demographic story about demand for commodities is so terrible. You know, I understand that there's cyclical aspects to it, et cetera, but man, we lived through a world that saw 3 to 5% population growth at various points in the 20th century. That is my reason for why we saw such inflationary characteristics in the 20th century. As I look at the 21st century, I just don't see it. I just don't see it. I mean, it's astonishing. Like, if you look at places like India that are actually seeing their population growth slow dramatically and the infrastructure investments start to be made that allow them to capitalize on the stuff, like India inflation's in the, you know, the fours, the fives sort of stuff now. Right. I mean, these are levels of inflation that we've never seen in emerging markets. China's back into deflation. All right. So where's this giant secular inflation that everybody told me about? It sure looks like it was transitory.
I mean, I think we'll see.
Yeah, you know, I agree, by the way.
I mean, you make a good point. And the interesting part about what we're seeing in China right now is that it does appear that the reopening is sputtering, and maybe they're concocting a new COVID story. I don't know. I never know what to believe when it's from China. But I know it's not possible to know the answer, but how do you think this debt ceiling free-for-all is going to play out, if you had to guess?
If we're playing the guessing game on the debt ceiling, I actually will tell you that I think it will almost certainly prioritize. We may have a moderate government shutdown that may lead to fears and events, but ultimately we're not going to default in a true sense in the United States. I mean, it is possible, but just remember, like, if you actually engage in a government shutdown, tax collections more than pay for the interest expense, right? So unless everybody suddenly decides to stop participating in the system in a giant vote of protest, which, by the way, is not outside the realm of possibility, we're not going to default on the bonds themselves. We could send through a fantastic negative fiscal impulse into the economy. This is the reverse of what we saw in 2020. And that would be very bad for the economy, and would likely lead to job loss and likely lead to the flows that I'm worried about beginning to reverse. And that's the sort of thing that I'm paying more attention to. A number of people have begun to talk about this, myself included, which is what I'm actually more concerned about is how they handle the resolution of the debt ceiling. And so if they decide to rapidly refill the TGA by issuing new bonds without the Fed moving to accommodate that, by making those bonds more attractive than, say, the reverse repo, which is Michael Howell, who's the best at this by far, points out, you know, those are just, reverse repo is effectively just the Treasury issuing bills, right? If the Federal Reserve were to coordinate with the Treasury to facilitate the refilling of the TGA by effectively drawing down reverse repo and increasing the TGA, you could mitigate some of those impacts. The evidence of coordination between the Fed and the Treasury is limited at best. And certainly the two personalities at play there, and Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell, do not seem to have a particularly fond relationship for each other. So like, that's kind of the thing I'm more focused on, is this dynamic of what does it look like when you have the resolution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything ranging from the Fitch warning on down is suggesting that elements of a repeat of 2011 are underway. The difference between 2011 and today is in 2011, everything was already operating off of an incredible stress buffer, right? So volatility was super elevated. Unemployment was already relatively high. People had cut back significantly on their spending. In the aftermath of the global financial crisis, debt levels were falling, interest rates were low. All those sort of wonderful things were in place to cushion the impact of that downgrade. I don't know this time. It seems much more like this is a catalyst that could push us over into an event not dissimilar to what happened in Europe around that time as well. And this does sound hyperbolic, but I just want to, you know, frame it in this context. If I look at what's happening in California versus Texas, for example, or Florida, the narrative is emerging that looks an awful lot like the Greek crisis, right? You know, well, California is going to get its comeuppance, right? We're going to really, you know, if Republicans are in charge, we can't wait to stick it to the blue states, right? The blue states can't wait to stick it to the red states if they could. And we're seeing a very fractured behavior. You know, Google the search term Texas, right? Texas deciding to bail out. That was really a huge chunk of the discussion around the Eurozone crisis is, will Germany walk away?
Well, so I think at a minimum, what you're saying is whatever outcome that we get on the debt ceiling is going to be trickier and more complicated than I think people have been expecting. And
well, certainly than what markets appear to be pricing in.
Yeah.
Right. So, I think that would be the bigger emphasis.
And so my shorthand version has been, they're not going to actually get anything done until they get some real pressure from the stock market or the economy, but the markets would do it first. So do you think it's fair to say that we're going to need some downside pressure in the market to get these guys and gals to finally come up with something they can call a plan?
I mean, I think we're seeing downside pressure in the market. It's just not the equity market, right? So, I mean, look at what's happening to the bond market right now, for example, right?
Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
You know, so I don't think it's, you know, myself and others have pointed out that when we start talking about, you know, 1 month interest rates are 7%, you know, on U.S. bonds, like, you know, remember that these are actually bills. And so that's a discounted component. It's a function of the face value. And literally the difference between like 5% and 4% in a 2 week bond is basis points on price, right? It's tiny, tiny elements of it. But I do think we're actually starting to see that chaos reflected in the bond market. But equities don't care precisely because those, you know, those, that small fraction of bonds that are being affected in that manner, go back to the portfolio rebalance channel. They're a relatively small portion of the index. It's not impacting the price of BND, just to you know, put a ticker on it. Mm-hmm. And as a result, like, I just don't think it flows through in any meaningful way in affecting how people are allocating to the equity markets, or even for that matter, risk credit markets, until the actual catalyst emerges, right? Until somebody loses their job, until the net contributions go in the opposite way. Candidly, there's no, you know, while I don't think that it's short covering driving NVIDIA, empirically, short cover, you know, shorts in NVIDIA just took $2 billion worth of losses overnight, right? That's a lot of money to lose for the active manager community that's already getting hammered. So when we start thinking about those things, what's your incentive to get in front of it? Other than being called a hero afterwards, right? And getting the giant, you know, big short call right, right? It's all about ego at this point.
Luckily, there's not too much of that in financial markets.
Exactly. Not too much. I mean, look, I certainly have no shortage of it. But the point that I would make is that I do think that there are some really interesting trades that are beginning to open up and emerge that always have those embedded catalysts. And, you know, series that I'm pointing out to people, I don't know if you guys track things like CMBX, which is, you know, the commercial mortgage-backed securities market. CMBX 16, I think, came out at 95. It's already at 79, right? So, wow. Like, that's in 3 months, right? I mean, like, these are phenomenal deteriorations that we're seeing. You know, the commercial real estate heavy series is just being demolished. We're seeing losses that look big short-like and that sort of stuff. And you're seeing, you know, building after building in downtown locations, you know, the equity is just literally walking away and saying to the credit, here, let's have it. You know, you guys can have it.
Yeah.
That's not stuff that you see in robust economies. I'm sorry.
No, this is the big version of jingle mail from when the SNLs went bust in the early 80s.
And we are seeing something that looks an awful lot like that. And then the other thing that I would just add is, if you look for unemployment in the right places, I would suggest is starting to emerge. So amongst college grads, you know, those who work in the white collar labor force, they're seeing their jobs under pressure. They're seeing job openings fall sharply. You know, I've written about this in my Substack. You know, it's what's called the Beveridge curve, is the relationship between unemployment and job openings. And candidly, like, there can be job openings in landscaping, and it's going to take a really long time before neurosurgeons are desperate enough to take landscaping jobs, right? Like, they just don't cross over in terms of the supply characteristics, right? And by the way, like, gardeners can become neurosurgeons. It just takes 15 years of credentialism, right? So, you know, these things take much longer once you start moving across. And if you look within those segments, it's a much less healthy picture.
So, Mike, let me ask you a question that I am flabbergasted Bill hasn't asked you yet, taking it to somewhere else in the world, and that's Japan, and the change in governor and the fragility of their yield curve control experiment. Obviously, the markets are sniffing that change is in the wind. What's your take on that? Do you think that the BOJ is going to be forced out of that yield curve control given the inflationary dynamics that are picking up in Japan of all places?
So the reason I would argue that inflationary characteristics are picking up in Japan is, ironically, because Japan is now being forced to confront the reality that the U.S. may not be able to protect it, and therefore it has to actually start putting together its own military. It has to start spending on its own defense. It has to start recalling investment that it had, in China and putting it locally. I don't think any of that makes Japan a more attractive destination for capital. And in fact, you know, all the hoopla around the Nikkei making a 30-year high sort of thing, if you adjust it for dollars and express it in U.S. dollar terms, that's just not true. It actually double topped back in 2021. And if anything, you know, your best case scenario is you've got some consolidation ahead of you. So I'm less enthusiastic about the Japan story than everybody else is. I also just candidly don't actually believe that the correct story is, hey, let's get inflation. I've never actually believed in this story of, you know, well, the solution to debt is just to inflate it away. Because it's never happened that I'm aware of, right? I mean, where that has occurred, you've had to destroy the currency first before you actually come out the other side of it. And so if we want to have a discussion around, like, could Japan's currency collapse? Sure, I think that's probably going to take longer. But I do think it's actually really interesting. I mean, I look at the UK and I look at Japan, and, you know, kind of think in both situations, like, there before the grace of God go I, right? These are small island nations, neither which is remotely capable of pursuing the sort of autarkic solutions that exist for the United States as a large continental power. Their special relationship with the United States, I think, remains intact, but they're both, you know, effectively on the shores of relatively hostile fronts. And it's not like the problems are being solved. Do I think that Japan is doing a better job of opening their arms to immigration, that they're beginning to do a better job of recognizing that they need to actually start reinvesting domestically? Yes. But I don't know, guys. To me, this still feels like a false dawn.
Yeah, from someone that's been following and trading and living in Japan for best part of 40 years now, I've got to say, I disagree. I think it's not the beginning of some sort of crazy phase, but I think there's a chance to make money here in Japan. But I'm curious to know what you think any end to yield curve control in Japan would have in terms of ripple effects for the rest of the world. Because that's really the big question here, is what does that do in terms of disrupting capital flows around the world?
I guess the quick answer is that what you're describing is a market that, like Europe, should have had to follow the US with much higher rates, right? So Europe, I would argue, thinks it's fighting inflation. It's really trying to keep pace with the Fed. And, you know, the UK, for example, with 13% inflation, in my analysis, has almost nothing to do with the level of interest rates. I'm just not seeing any evidence that, you have is, you know, runaway, you know, speculative behavior in the UK. And I think that's broadly true everywhere, right? So in Japan, weirdly enough, if you were to actually remove yield curve control, you would effectively get rid of the last element of QE that exists out there and potentially create conditions under which conditions tighten dramatically around the world. I would be surprised if they're forced to do that, but they might end up there. Let me ask the question differently. what would you see in Japan that is actually suggesting, other than the trailing data in which their inflation is running way below everybody else, every other island nation in the world's inflation rate? Do you really think that there's an inflationary characteristic to Japan suddenly?
No, it's definitely not an inflation story. It's possibly an end of deflation story and a return to some kind of mild inflation. I guess the difference.
So how is that good for Japan, though? So let me actually flip it on its head, because as I said, I don't have a really strong opinion on it, but I'm certainly open to you having a very different view.
I don't think this idea that Japan needs inflation has been. In fact, I wrote about it last month. I mean, the average inflation in Japan for the last 25, 30 years has been 0.7%. If your job as a central bank is to create stable prices, hand the BOJ a gold medal, right? It's done.
Yep.
So I'm with you. I think this inflation story is a bit of a non-starter. But in terms of pressure on the JGB market, in terms of money coming back into Japan from abroad, in terms of relative value equity allocations, if people start to think the US is way overpriced, I just think Japan is a home for capital for many of those reasons. Now, that you can debate the currency versus bond situation, because something's got to give somewhere, but Japan has just been ground zero for QE for so long. I'm really curious to understand the world in which Japan is forced out of yield curve control the way Australia was, and given the dynamics of that bond market, what that might do as that ripples outwards.
Well, I would say it slightly differently, and then we can see what Mike says. I can construct an argument that if they abandon yield curve control and it didn't end the world, which I don't know exactly how it's going to play out, you would see the yen appreciate. And if the yen were to appreciate, I could see how they could have a period there where their own capital would flow back, perhaps outside capital would flow. But the $64 quadrillion question is, what happens when they end yield curve control? Because if things don't collapse, I believe the yen would rally and they could see a good period. Now, anyway, I led with my chin. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, let me ask it on the other side, right? So if you're describing higher bond yields in Japan, and that in turn attracts capital to Japan to take advantage of the higher yields, causing yen appreciation and everything else that you're describing, what does that actually do fundamentally for Japan in your model that allows it to move beyond the underlying demographic challenges? Because it doesn't appear that Japan's issue is capital shortage, is I guess the way I would frame it.
No, I think your demographic point is an excellent one. But I do think the psychological component, otherwise known as animal spirits or whatever, can impact the equity of flows, particularly if it depends how much bond rates go up when YCC ends, I believe. And this is the part that I think is especially unknowable. I have no position in any of this, but as an intellectual thought exercise, it all depends, in my mind, where rates go. Because if they go up 100%, but we're only really talking about 100 beeps, or 140 beeps or some number like that, that's only a big deal relative to where we've been. It's not going to get in the way of anything. If they ended YCC, they would probably need to do some other things from an incentive standpoint to get capital flowing. But of course, they're notorious for coming up with ideas that don't actually add anything to GDP other than the initial spend, the euphemistic bridges to nowhere. So
right.
I don't really, I'm allowing myself to be open to the possibility that it could turn out in different ways, because I don't really know. I'm hoping that when it starts to happen, things will break in a way that makes sense to me and I can maybe capitalize on it. I've been waiting a long time to take a shot at something like that, but I'm still waiting.
Yeah. To me, it is a really hard one. So I understand what people are saying about the dynamic of inflation providing effectively a spur for investment and growth in Japan. Theoretically frees up capital that needs to be, capital that is accumulated in savings and that needs to be pushed back into the economy, and that can create a virtuous cycle. I just don't see the evidence for that, right? I mean, that would be for Japan to succeed at this point. Remember that Japan is really, what I would argue, Japan is really experiencing is a reversal of the negative trade character, you know, terms of trade that existed last year, right? So a lot of the bounce to me in Japan feels just like the reversal of the trade dynamics that that existed last year, as well as some recognition, just like we have in the United States, that you need to, you know, start reinvesting in supply chain, you know, and putting some stuff back in, right? So, like, those elements are positive. I think ultimately there is a stimulative aspect of Japan deciding to spend on its military and deciding to reshore many strategic activities. But the evidence to me is still really slim that this is any form of structural change. And candidly, I think the bigger story that exists right now is exactly what you said, which is people worried about the U.S. have decided to flow, you know, money internationally in kind of a, you know, almost a more cynical version of 2008's decoupling hypothesis, right? Then it was decoupling because the U.S. was slowing and the rest of the world's growth was going to remain. And this is almost like a decoupling where it's like, well, the U.S. is so ridiculously overvalued, so let's allocate to far more economically cyclical regions of the world in the hopes that, you know, we can avoid the ramifications of a global slowdown that could hit valuations in the United States. And my reaction to that is like, wait, did I hear you correctly? It doesn't seem like the right trade, but I could be wrong.
Well, listen, right? we're running out of time, and I'd like to give you a chance. I know you can't talk CUSIPs, but I think there are probably a lot of people that are listening that don't really know what the family of products that you have at Simplify. So do you want to give the listeners a little commercial that won't get you in trouble with compliance?
Sure. Should I sing it? Or
if you can do it through the art of mime, that would be perfect.
I don't know if we have the nerve to listen to singing, Mike.
Yeah, no, that would be we would immediately destroy the audience to the end game. So very quickly, Simplify is an ETF firm that was launched in September of 2020 to take advantage of a series of rule changes that made it much easier to offer ETFs that offer unique investment profiles. And so Simplify has basically spent the last couple of years creating ETFs that offer what would traditionally be viewed as a series of alternative investment exposures, everything ranging from macro strategies to short volatility strategies, long volatility strategies, dividend enhancement, credit funds that have credit protection embedded in them designed to protect against credit cycles. And, you know, we've fully embraced the overall idea of ETFs and indexing by offering them in a generally low cost framework. And so our funds typically range from 25 to 75 basis points in management fees, well below most of our peers in the actively managed space, although higher than the pure index funds. And, you know, we've been very fortunate to have grown very nicely over the past couple of years. We're approaching $2 billion in AUM. And, you know, so if you want hedge fund-like strategies or alternative exposure strategies, whether those are trend following, levered expressions of interest rates, macro strategies, short vol strategies, protection strategies, we're offering a variety of those types of products. We've been, as I said, very fortunate both through a combination of performance and a little bit, the tiniest little bit of brand awareness to grow into a space that candidly has been shrinking overall. And so, you know, the active manager world is a very tough place. One of the reasons I spend so much time trying to educate people around the dangers of passive is because if we don't change it, you know, there is no growth for any of us. And so, while I'm thrilled with the growth we've experienced, and I genuinely deeply appreciate the vote of confidence that we've received from our investors, as I like to joke, you know, 2 years of my life have been spent taking in one day of inflows for Vanguard, right? So I encourage people to look us up. You can find us at www.simplified.us. We offer a series of funds. We're available on many different platforms. You can buy us, like most ETFs, with a simple click of a ticker. And for compliance reasons, obviously, I can't talk about all those things, but it has been a very gratifying experience. And we're thrilled with the reception that we've had.
phenomenal, Mike, and the success is well deserved. We have run out of time. We'll give one quick plug for your Twitter and your Substack, because again, people can read your work there, and it's always exceptional.
Oh, well, that's really kind of you. So my Twitter is at profplum99, and my Substack can be found in my Twitter bio, but it's yes, I give a fig, which refers to a ticker, actually, on Substack. And you know, more than happy to extend discounts or scholarships to anyone who cannot afford to subscribe. We are going to be actually going paid on June 1st.
It's expensive though. It's what, $10 a month, Mike?
Yeah, no, we're really grinding people down for it. But my objective is not to make money, but also, but much more just to not waste my time, right? And I personally find that I'm much more invested in reading and responding to things that I actually have to pay for, and so I just rather have a higher quality audience, even if it means that unfortunately I have to lose a lot of people. But I am really serious. I'll extend, you know, scholarships to anyone who asks, no questions asked.
You're a champion. Mike, listen, I'm so pleased that everything's going so well. It's a really good thing when you see good guys smashing it out of the park. So congratulations, continued success to you, my friend, and let's chat again soon.
Thank you very much, Grant. I appreciate it.
It's funny, at the very end, it talked about the $10 a month. You know, I've been writing my column since 1996. And,
is that long now? Jeez.
Yeah. And of course, first I got a bunch of stock options to write it. And anyway, when I started my own site, I had the same logic as Mike. Like, I don't really want to make money on this, but if they won't pay for it, it's not worth writing, you know? So I've charged the same digit for it just for the same reason.
See, then this is your mandate, stable prices. And you, like the Bank of Japan, have delivered in spades. Maybe there is a role for you at the central bank after all, Fleck. We always thought that was never going to happen for you. Your day was never going to come.
Yeah,
I tell you,
yeah.
You know, every time I talk to Mike, I come away feeling, as I've said this before, simultaneously dumber and smarter than before the conversation started, every time.
Yeah, and what I particularly think is interesting is how this, you know, I remember when I first had my eyes open to what passive had done to the markets, and now I've watched it keenly and for obvious reasons. But it's really amazing to see how this has evolved. And in just the 3 years since 2020, you can actually feel how much this incremental little bit of more market share they get each year is starting to make things a little squirrelier and squirrelier. Or at least I think I can. That's a subjective observation.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Well, listen, that was a long episode of The Endgame, my friend. I guess all that is left is for us to thank our guest, Mike Green. Once again, his Twitter is at profplum99, and his Substack is Yes, I Do Give a Fig, and the company website is simplify.us. I can't urge you strongly enough to check any of those three or all of those three out if you haven't done so already. Thanks to you once again for listening. We'll be back with another Endgame at some point in the near future, I'm sure. Until then, Fleck's Twitter handle is
at FleckCap.
Yes, it is.
And yours is?
And mine is at TTMYGH, which is nice and easy. Thank you very much. We'll see you soon. Nothing we discussed during The Endgame should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.